Lecture 18, Indian Sultans.
Often, the history of the Indian subcontinent over the past millennium has been seen in terms of religious conflict, a clash of civilizations, particularly Muslims versus Hindus. Certainly, today both Pakistan and Bangladesh identify themselves as Islamic nations. But the Republic of India proclaims itself secular and has a large Muslim minority, almost as large as the population of either Pakistan or Bangladesh. Further, no pre-colonial state, even the various sultanates we'll discuss in this lecture, was ever purely Muslim. Conversely, after the founding of Islam in the 7th century, there were increasing numbers of Muslims in most so-called Hindu kingdoms. Indeed, wars and clashes were quite often between rulers of the same religious community, Muslims versus Muslims and Hindus versus Hindus. So a binary division between Muslims and Hindus greatly oversimplifies the complex interactions among diverse and greatly overlapping Indian communities. Yet we should also note that in theory, Muslims and Hindus do not reciprocally characterize each other in the same way. On the one hand, a core principle of Islamic theology is a clear division between those who submit to Allah as Muslims and those who do not. Many polemical texts written by Muslim scholars and many actions taken by Muslim rulers highlight this distinction. However, the widespread actual practice of virtually all Muslim rulers in India was quite different. Within almost every sultanate, the vast majority of the population was Hindu, as was much of the administration. So the state could not survive if it insisted on being purely Muslim. Even among the Muslims living in these sultanates, many had Hindu ancestors, as noted in the last lecture. Indeed, a few sultans had themselves been born Hindu and later converted to Islam. Thus, most Muslims in India were culturally quite mixed. So Muslim sultans adopted and worked with Hindus wherever practical. On the other hand, Hinduism's conception of human society is far more diverse and hierarchical. The Sanskrit concept of mleccha has historically been used to describe outsiders or foreigners to India. These are people who live outside the sacred land of India and its moral regime. But once outsiders settled in India, most were assimilated to different degrees into its society. You'll recall from earlier lectures that Parsi, Jewish, and Christian people who immigrated to ancient India adopted caste-like features. The relatively few Muslims who immigrated did so as well. These communities of former outsiders therefore functioned in many ways as Indian jatis, even though there's no theological basis in their particular religion for such hierarchies. Plus, some groups from Central Asia, like the Shakas or Scythians, or the Hunna or Huns, seem to have become Rajput caste Hindus over time. Conversely, sometimes members of Hindu Rajput clans converted to Islam without completely breaking with their clansmen who remained Hindu. Therefore, in practice, identification as Hindu or Muslim often seems to matter less socially and culturally than Indian clan or jati identity. One of the most prominent ways that the alleged clash between Muslims and Hindus has been symbolized is in temple destruction. Strict Orthodox Islamic theology forbids the worship of images, especially of deities other than Allah. So some Muslim rulers have proclaimed their commitment to Islam on occasion by destroying a Hindu temple. But these relatively few instances obscure the fact that Muslim rulers in India far more generally left Hindu temples alone or even gave support to them. In fact, Muslim rulers usually only destroyed a temple patronized by one of their political or military enemies. Moreover, as we've seen, Hindu rulers also destroyed the temples of their enemies. So what's really a complex political issue is sometimes seen, even today, as a simple religious one. Merely counting only the number of Hindu temples destroyed by Muslims is very misleading. As the American scholars Richard Eaton and Philip Wagoner have insightfully shown in their recent book, Power, Memory, Architecture, there's really a spectrum of how both Muslim and Hindu rulers treated captured temples over the centuries. The extensive research by these scholars shows what they categorize as four broad types of policies. Most often, a Muslim or Hindu conqueror simply left captured temples alone. Most temples were not closely identified with an enemy, so there was no political gain in destroying it. Indeed, the hostility of those who worship in that temple would be counterproductive for the new ruler. Eaton and Wagoner call this most widespread and prevalent policy non-intervention. Sometimes the new ruler, either Hindu or Muslim, even took over the patronage of prominent temples. There are many instances of Muslim rulers giving grants of money or tax-free land to an existing Hindu temple or paying for its renovation. This often gained them the support of the local population who worshiped there. It also fulfilled the ancient Indic model of the ruler as guardian of morality and patron of public festivals and worship. In other instances, the new ruler redefined an existing temple. For example, he might make a temple into a mosque by adding a mihrab, that is the prayer niche that points the way to Mecca, or by adding one or more minarets for the call to prayer, or domes that evoked Islamicate architecture. Taking a famous example from another land, Turkey, the Greek Orthodox Christian Basilica of Hagia Sophia became a Muslim mosque, but now it's a secular museum. If you study closely the actual architectural history of some buildings, you'll find that some have been redefined in this way. Finally, there is reassemblage, where the actual stones of a temple were reused to build another structure. Sometimes this was another temple, sometimes a mosque. The ways that the impressive stones with their refined carvings were recycled could add prestige to the new temple or mosque and to the aesthetic reputation of its patron. Architectural historians can now identify the earlier styles of sculpture and even the mineral composition of the stones to trace the history not just of the building, but also of where its material parts came from. Thus, the relationships between Islam and Hinduism and the interactions between Muslims and Hindus have historically been quite complex. By looking at the first 8 centuries of Muslim rule over parts of South Asia, we can explore more insightfully some of these processes. We already saw that the dynamic advance of conquest by Muslims had, by 711, reached Sindh in the lower Indus plain, when an army under Muhammad bin al-Qasim created an extension of the Islamic Caliphate there. This was less than a century after Islam had been proclaimed by the Prophet Muhammad. This also represented an early introduction into India of a culture that originated in Arabia and carried with it many new foreign concepts. But relatively few Muslims actually ever immigrated, and gradually this became more of an Indian-based sultanate. This sultanate made itself independent of the caliphate by 985. So there was also a strongly Indian aspect to this and all other later Muslim states in South Asia. Various expeditions over the next century by Sindh's sultans over and up the Indus River plain were largely contained by the various Hindu rulers around. Many of these rulers were Rajputs, who were themselves trying to expand into the Indus River plain. But since the death of Harsha in 647, there had been no single dominant stable empire in India. Instead, various rival Hindu-ruled kingdoms fought bitterly against each other, even as trade and commerce generally expanded, not only within India, but also westward to the Mediterranean and eastward to Southeast Asia. Some rajas fleetingly conquered widely, but no dynasty retained control over territories outside of its core for very long. Meanwhile, from the 8th century onward, Muslim rulers had expanded overland across Iran and established themselves in what is today Afghanistan. The most aggressive of these sought to conduct even more distant raids into the richer lands of India. Scholars have identified over 90 distinct military clashes involving Muslim and Indian non-Muslim rulers during the period 636 to 1205. But that only averages one every 6 years. And that number is also misleading, since many of these were undertaken by a single ruler. Sultan Mahmud of Ghazni, who was responsible for 17 of those clashes in particular. Between 998 and 1030, his armies raided throughout the Punjab and the rest of the Indus Plain. Among Mahmud's expeditions, one was against the current Muslim Sultan of Sindh in 1008. So Mahmud may have tried to use Islam to fire up his warriors and to justify his conquests, but his main goal was mercenary, not religious. Next, the Ghurid clan seized power in Afghanistan and continued this pattern of raids into India. By the end of the 12th century, Muhammad Ghuri had conquered Sindh and the territory as far east as Bengal. The speed of his war horses enabled them to outflank the often larger, slower, elephant-centered forces of his Indian opponents. Since horses do not thrive in India, control over their importation gave him and other Muslim rulers with links to Central and West Asia a decisive military advantage. These Afghan rulers relied heavily on a system of military and administrative slaves. They captured or purchased young boys, often from the nomadic Turkish communities who migrated around in Central Asia. These rulers then raised and trained these slaves to be loyal warriors. The most skilled of the slaves became generals who might command major expeditions, with many of their officers and soldiers also being slaves. When these slave generals captured territory, they were often entrusted by their owner and ruler with governing those lands. These kinds of slaves were known in the Islamic world as Mamluks, and they also became prominent in Egypt during the period from 1250 to 1517. The advantages for the ruler of this system of military administrative slavery included his capacity to expand greatly the body of men loyal to him. In contrast, using the ruler's own sons as his commanders and governors had limitations. He could not increase the number of sons very rapidly, no matter how much he tried. Further, sons often challenged their father, trying to overthrow him and take over the throne for themselves. Unlike sons, slaves could not legally inherit either property or rule, at least in theory. When they died, whatever they possessed went to their owner. They had no political authority independent of their master. But these slaves could rise high as long as they retained the approval of their ruler and master. In the case of Muhammad Ghuri, he ordered his slave general, Qutbuddin Aibek, to command the key fortified outpost at Delhi. This was a long-time strategic location on the Jamna River, which is the western boundary of the Ganges River plain. Most trading and raiding from Afghanistan had to pass through a relatively narrow land corridor through the Delhi region. The foothills of the Himalayas lined the northern part of this corridor. The Rajasthan Desert lay along its south. The northern spur of the Aravalli Hills also defined the Delhi region geographically. Water running off those rocky hills fed the wells and streams that made it possible for Delhi to be more densely populated than many other places. Additionally, just to the east of Delhi lay the especially fertile agricultural lands from which rulers could extract revenues. Thus, many rulers have built their capitals at Delhi, the earliest capital being Indraprastha, dating back to probably the 4th century BCE, with many others following, the most recent being the British Raj declaring New Delhi to be its imperial capital in 1911. From Delhi, armies commanded by Qutbuddin, manned by his fellow slaves, roamed widely, collecting spoils that he then passed on to his owner, Muhammad Ghuri, at least until Ghuri's death in 1206. Thereafter, Qutbuddin held on to Delhi, obtained his personal freedom from the weak Ghurid successors, and proclaimed himself Sultan. Qutbuddin and his band of Mamluk generals then ruled collectively as the first of the 5 dynasties of the Delhi Sultanate. Qutbuddin was succeeded in 1211 as Sultan by another Turkish manumitted slave general, Iltutmish. Having deposed the remaining Ghurid rulers in Afghanistan and Sindh, Iltutmish sent gifts to the Abbasid Caliph, asking for authorization for his own independent regime. Then in 1221, a Mongol invasion by Genghis Khan ravished Afghanistan. This drove various people, including artists, artisans, scholars, and warriors, to immigrate eastward into India. They brought with them Persian literary culture and architectural forms, like the dome and the arch, which all became marks of sophisticated culture. This also strengthened the independence of the Delhi Sultanate relative to its former masters. There would be repeated Mongol invasions up to the Indus River over the next century that kept Afghanistan weak while the Delhi Sultanate fought to repel them and rose in power. As the Mamluk regime stabilized, it regularized their system of taxation over the surrounding region. When Iltutmish died of cancer in 1236, he tried to pass on his rule to his daughter, Razia. This was unusual, both because it was an inheritance from the Sultan to his child instead of to another Mamluk commander, and also because she was a rare Muslim woman ruler. She was clearly a strong personality, but there was much opposition from other Mamluks who wanted power for themselves. Finally, after 4 years of perilous rule, she was assassinated in 1240. Then in 1266, another Turk slave commander, the ruthless Baldan, killed the incumbent Sultan, whose daughter he had married. Over the next 2 decades, Baldan ruled, consolidating power in his own hands. Cut off from his Central Asian homeland, he increased the pace of Indianization. But without a clear line of dynastic descent, almost every succession among these Mamluks led to battles among contenders, and no ruler could feel secure even in his own court. The period of these Turkish slave generals ended soon after Baldan's death, when the Khalji clan seized power in 1290. The Khaljis were Afghan Turks who had settled in India. This dynasty moved toward a more centralized kingship model, where the Sultan was supreme and the strongest of his descendants acceded to the throne. The most famous of this dynasty, Alauddin, had been a governor under his uncle and father-in-law, whom he assassinated. Alauddin then built up his own power as Sultan, ruling from 1295 to 1316. He also led armies far into the south. He conquered all the way to Madurai, but his successors proved incapable of holding on to his conquest or even power in Delhi. After only 30 years of rule, the Khaljis were overthrown by one of their own slave commanders who founded the Tughluq dynasty in 1320. For nearly a century, the Tughluqs held on to the power in the Sultanate. The most famous and dynamic of these Tughluq rulers was Muhammad Shah. He seized the throne from his own father in 1325 and then ruled for a quarter century. He tried various innovations in order to expand and deepen his regime. He even recentered his kingdom by moving his capital over 750 miles south to a city he renamed Dalalabad. But this experiment failed, and he shifted his court back to Delhi once again. Muhammad Shah tried to expand his administration's finances by issuing copper coins that were denominated to be worth more than the value of their metal content. But this also failed, since forgers simply produced similar coins and demanded their nominal value in gold or silver from the royal treasury. He also tried to add to his regime's legitimacy by adopting many of the symbols of kingship in Indic traditions, like mounting elephants for his public processions. Further, he sent an embassy to Cairo, seeking from the Abbasid caliph there a declaration of the legitimacy of his reign. These efforts show how the Delhi Sultanate regarded itself as part of both the Indic and also the wider Islamic worlds. We know much about the life at the court, capital, and kingdom of Muhammad Tughlaq from the richly detailed travel journal, or Rihla, of Ibn Battuta. He was a scholar from Morocco who traveled throughout the Islamic world, living for 8 years in India, starting in 1333. When he reached Muhammad Tughlaq's court in Delhi, his prestige as a scholar from the Islamic West gained him an appointment as a judge of Islamic law. In addition, he was made the manager of a well-endowed mausoleum of an earlier sultan. This endowment was the revenue from 30 villages. It more than paid for the 460 attendants who worked under Ibn Battuta's supervision. But Ibn Battuta lived extravagantly beyond even this generous income. He ran up huge debts that he could not pay off. Instead, using his polished Arabic language skills, he wrote a poem dedicated to Muhammad. Graciously, the Sultan not only paid off the debt, but he also gave Ibn Battuta much more than that besides. But the Sultan was both generous and pitilessly arbitrary. Anyone who even slightly annoyed him was tortured and executed. So Ibn Battuta decided that remaining at the Delhi court was too dangerous. He wished to find a gracious way of leaving and also to continue his travels. So Ibn Battuta accepted a place in the Sultan Muhammad's embassy that was being sent to escort a delegation of 15 Chinese ambassadors back to the Yuan imperial court. The Sultan entrusted Ibn Battuta with gifts for the Chinese emperor, including 200 Hindu slaves, singers and dancers, 15 young courtiers, 100 horses, and an array of costly textiles, dishware, and swords. Ibn Battuta then left Delhi, taking with him much wealth and also his several Indian concubines, one of them pregnant with his child. Showing just how thin was sultanate rule and how unsettled was the countryside, this richly laden embassy was attacked less than 100 miles from Delhi. In the melee, Ibn Battuta was separated from the rest of the delegation. He describes how he was captured and nearly killed by bandits who took everything that he had except for his trousers. But they finally showed pity and allowed him to escape. Ibn Battuta spent the next week hungrily seeking the rest of the embassy, but he feared the Sultan's wrath if he returned to court in disgrace. So he continued with remnants of the embassy, eventually going on to China before wending his way back to Morocco. Reading about Ibn Battuta's adventures gives us a wonderful sense of what traveling was like at that time. There is a description of his journey published by Ross E. Dunn and a translation by H.A.R. Gibb. The next sultan of the Tughlaq dynasty, Firuz Shah, was selected by the leading generals and theologians at court in 1351. One historian and prominent Sunni Islamic theologian, Ziauddin Barani, wrote a tariq, or Persian language history of the reign. This tariq genre of history is similar to Western-style histories that we're all familiar with. The narrative proceeds chronologically, recounting the words and deeds of humans, although occasional references to Allah's will appear. There is a clear awareness of the need to test evidence separating hearsay and unreliable sources from reliable ones. This genre differed from the various indigenous Indian types of history that we've seen earlier in India, but it would become widespread. Sultan Firuz Shah also consulted with Barney on the best way to rule the Sultanate. That scholar explained how Islamic theology regarding the equality of humans as creations of Allah should be reconciled with the Jati system prevalent within the Sultanate. Barney tortuously explained that God created all humans as equal, but then allotted them appropriate degrees of virtue and vice. Quote, in one, he implanted writing and penmanship, to another, horsemanship, to one, the craft of weaving, to yet another, farriery, and yet to another, carpentry. All these crafts, honorable and base, were implanted in their minds and breasts, unquote. So it was the duty of the Sultan to preserve this caste-based social order, people who are, quote, noble, freeborn, virtuous, religious, of high lineage, and of pure birth, alone are worthy of offices and posts in the realm and under the government of the ruler. Further, teachers of every kind are to be strictly enjoined not to thrust precious stones down the throats of dogs or to put collars of gold round the necks of pigs and bears. That is, to the mean, ignoble, the worthless, to shopkeepers and the lowborn, they are to teach nothing more than the mandates about prayer, fasting, almsgiving, and pilgrimage to Mecca, along with some chapters of the Quran and some doctrines of the faith, without which their religion cannot be correct and valid, and prayers are not possible. They are to be instructed in nothing more, lest it bring honor to their mean souls. They are not to be taught reading or writing, for plenty of disorders arise owing to the skill of the lowborn in knowledge. Unquote. So in Barney's theology and the Hindu caste system are also valid in Islamic theology. At the same time, many Muslim rulers had spiritual and also political relationships with Muslim saints and other holy men called Sufis. By giving land and other gifts to these influential Sufis, the Muslim ruler gained the support of their spiritual power and also the loyalty and obedience of those holy men's popular following, which often included non-Muslims as well as Muslims. These gifts of land were often on the frontiers of the kingdom. So as Sufis brought this land into production, it increased the kingdom's material wealth as well. However, the Tughlaq Sultanate gradually fragmented. It lacked the manpower and administrative expertise to effectively control regions beyond its heartland around Delhi. The sultans, commanders, and governors successfully broke away to establish sultanates of their own, either temporarily or permanently. This occurred in Madurai in 1334, in Kashmir in 1339, in the Deccan in 1347, in Bengal in 1345, in Jampur in 1394, and in Gujarat in 1407. In addition, there were various regionally based kingdoms, many with Rajput or other Hindu rulers. Whenever possible, these subordinated regional rulers threw off the Sultan's overlordship. What became the largest of these kingdoms arose in the early 14th century in the southern Deccan, named after its capital, Vijayanagar, meaning City of Victory. The founders of this dynasty were brothers, Harihara and Bukka, who according to some accounts were Hindus who had converted to Islam and served in the army of the Sultanate, before striking out on their own and reconverting to Hinduism from 1336 onward. Their followers were mostly mixed Kannada and Telugu speakers and included Hindus and also Muslims. Now, while some outmoded histories try to pose Vijayanagar as a bastion of Hinduism against the Muslim sultanates, this erases many of their similarities in the forms of their administration, army, and culture. Finally, the Tughlaq regime was fatally weakened when another Central Asian Muslim, the Turkish warlord Timur, known in the West as Tamerlane, invaded India in 1398-99. He sacked Delhi, taking vast wealth and many skilled artisans back to his own capital, Samarkand. As he left, laden with loot, Timur installed a loyal governor in Delhi. This became a new dynasty that claimed to be Syeds, that is, Arabs descended from the Prophet Muhammad himself. But they could not stabilize their dynasty and were succeeded in 1451 by the fifth of the Delhi Sultanate dynasties, the Lodi Afghan clan. Gradually, the Lodis reconquered most of North India, reincorporating some of the remaining sultanates there. Though power was shared within the Lodi clan, one family managed to stay on the throne in Delhi for three quarters of a century until 1526. At that point, a descendant of Timur named Babur invaded from Afghanistan and founded the greatest of the Muslim and Indian pre-colonial states, the Mughal Empire, to which we will turn in the next lectures.